The electric car drew slowly to a halt. Right, stay here, William. I'll go and see if she's ready. Don't want you upsetting her again. What do you mean, upsetting her? She's quite capable of looking after herself, Ellie, despite her pleas of woe and doom. Anyway, didn't want to get out. I need to pop along to the nearest charging point. Got about 50 miles left. Ellie opened the cottage door quietly and entered her grandmother's house. Nan had her back to the door and was sat at the table with a collection of photo albums in front of her. She leafed through various pages as Ellie stood silently in the doorway. It was sometimes difficult to tell if Nan knew she had a visitor and was just ignoring them, or whether her selection of hearing aids was the wrong one. Over the years, her collection had grown, as had her boxes of various glasses and numerous walking sticks and aids. After a few moments, and without turning round, she spoke. "Don't just stand there, Ellie. Put the kettle on." Ellie realised that Nan had propped a small mirror against the windowsill and could see who had come into her home. She was 95 and had lived in her own for nearly 50 years, since she and her husband had separated. It had been an amicable arrangement, with Nan and her husband Jack meeting regularly and always being together at family events, parties and Christmas. However, for the past 10 years, family get-togethers had almost ceased as the immediate family had left Devon seeking work elsewhere and the grandchildren grew up. Nan's behaviour had also caused concerns and increasing worries, especially since Jack had died. "Here you are, Nan. Nice cup of tea. Any sugar?" "Yes, Nan, too, just as you like it." "How are you feeling, Nan? How are you?" "Sorry I haven't been able to see you since last week, but the kids have been ill again and I couldn't leave them." "Well, what about your sisters? Why couldn't they come?" "Nan, they don't live locally anymore. Megan is in London and Kenzie went to Australia last year. Don't you remember?" "Of course I remember. Listen, Ellie, I've lost a lot of things that were precious to me, but I haven't lost my marbles, you know." She paused. "Well, most of the time, that is. Anyway, where's your mother?" Without waiting for a reply, "Off with her new boyfriend, is she? Is that why she hasn't been near me in months?" "Nan, Mum died 5 years ago. You keep talking about her as if she still lived in the next village. Basically, I'm all you've got left, Nan. Does that make sense?" "Of course it does. And I do remember what happened to your mum. She was horrible to me sometimes. You don't forget people like that. Nan, I'm not going to stand here and listen to this. Half the time I'm sure you only say things for effect, rather than really forgetting." "Righto, Ellie. So what are you here for today?" "As if I couldn't guess. Oh, and by the way, where's your bloke? What's he called? William. Where is he? You think I've lost my mind? Well, let me tell you, I remember every cruel word he said last time. William's getting the car charged up so we can go and have a look again." "Look at what?" "The extra care scheme. Don't you remember? After the last planning permissions were refused by the Dartmoor National Park Authority, you agreed to move. Oh, so-and-sos never gave me a chance. All I wanted was to knock down the rear walls and extend the building so I could sleep, live, eat and do everything downstairs, and they refused point blank. Nan, this is a listed building. Apart from anything else, I knew you wouldn't have a chance with them, but you wouldn't listen. They are so entrenched in their attitude and views, even King Charles can't get permission to alter some of his properties. Queen Camilla gets absolutely livid, and at her age, it's not a pretty sight. She's the same age as me, and has had as much done to her as I have. Do you know, I've had two knee replacements, two hips done, cataracts removed, my hearing repaired, well, sort of. Still have to wear those things in your ear. You haven't mentioned the cell transplant, Nan, for your liver. Remember when you used to drink a little and they managed to save you once again? Once again, what are you talking about? I'm 95 and nearly a quarter of people in this country are approaching their 90s. Besides, I only drank because I was lonely, not seeing my family and all that. And then Jack died and it got even worse. Nan, look, we can talk about this all day, but it won't change things. You can't live here any more on your own. You burnt yourself last time on the solar ceramic heating tile we had installed. And despite the latest vacuum-inducted direct flush toilet, you're still having accidents, aren't you? Ellie, you just wait till you're my age. In the name of God, I hope you never have such ungrateful children and grandchildren. She turned to the picture album. See here, Ellie. Look at this. See that? 1946, Croydon, after the Blitz. That's me in the pram with my mum, just after the war. Which war, Nan?
As always, when arriving somewhere new, he felt as if his strangeness was recognised. However hard he scrubbed his skin or combed his hair, however neatly his beard was trimmed, there were always cuts or grazes and a certain smell of forest floors and wood smoke that exuded from him, which set him apart. And he was never sure whether this perception was accurate or not. Perhaps it was only his furtive response to it that aroused attention. But he'd noticed that the sense of not belonging, of otherness, in an unfamiliar town was becoming more acute. People tended to stay in the same place more these days. First it had been necessity, now it was becoming habitual. It was not something he himself desired, but as he walked up the twisting, narrow high street of Old Ashburton, he noticed that the faces of passers-by seemed to be suffused with a glow of contentment. Or perhaps that was just the light, which had dropped lower and gilded the pavement in a final burst before it dropped behind the buildings. He was waiting for nightfall. A breach can never be committed in broad daylight, due to its very nature as an act of trespass. Whilst Robin herself did not necessarily consider a foray into one of Britain's wild spaces a transgression, the law, unfortunately, was not on his side. When his mother had been younger, people had been free to walk as they chose across public land. She'd camped on Dartmoor before, lots of times. He'd seen the photos and knew she'd been at the protests when the law passing the cordoning off of wild spaces had come into effect. He understood the necessity for this, a way to protect the almost parasitic colonisation of all available spaces for more houses, to ensure that trees weren't cut down for firewood or lakes dredged for water. But that didn't prevent him from wanting to go to the forest or the hills and spend as much time as he could there until threat of discovery or hunger drove him away. And there was something special about moorland. He'd looked through his binoculars at the boulder-strewn landscape of Inner Dartmoor and felt his pulse race as he imagined climbing the austere granite faces of the Tors. He'd done his research. In his backpack was the most up-to-date map of the secured-off area he'd been able to find, and he'd already chosen where he was going to camp. It was a fertile valley in between the scraggy, exposed moors, where he could see the meandering blue line that indicated a river. Just because it had been there once did not necessarily mean it would be there now, but hopefully the dampness and fertility of the ground would remain. It was mushroom season, and they were a necessary protein when hunting was unsuccessful. Thinking about it, perhaps it would be better if the river wasn't at full flow, or there at all, because animals might come up there to drink at night and then pick up his scent. He swallowed, nervously, imagining the pallid glow of carnivorous eyes encircling a campfire, claws through smoke, sharp teeth through flesh. Nothing had been proven about the translocation of predators, and yet, he jumped backwards as he felt teeth clamp down upon his shirt. He took a sharp intake of breath, which luckily prevented a scream, because when he looked down at his shirt, he found himself staring at the square teeth and frazzled mane of a pot-bellied pony. The pony was attached to a halter, which was being listlessly held by a spotty and disgruntled-looking girl, a few years younger than himself. As she didn't pull the pony away, or even crack a smile at its misdemeanour, he didn't feel any particular affinity towards her or the pony. "Ouch, that didn't hurt," said the spotty girl. "It could have." "But it didn't," she said. "Ponies only eat grass. They would never hurt a human. It's just you probably smell weird. Thanks."
There was something or someone in the back garden. Agatha, staring absent-mindedly out the window as she filled the kettle, noted movement, she thought. Was it a body bent double or a largish animal? Perhaps a big dog that had slipped behind and rustled the choicier shrub in the corner, near both the high brick wall and the converted double garage, the one that now served as a stable for her two Dartmoor ponies and their wooden trap. She lingered there with a full kettle, watched sunlight paint the top of the wall. Nothing beyond the slow turn of the earth and the faint workings of a breeze. The watch was disturbed by the yawny grunt greeting of Mavis, her 14-year-old daughter. "Don't take your time today, please," was her mother's response. "I need to be out there earning money, PDQ. I got the car tax reminder yesterday and it's gone up again, by a lot. We'll have to forget about motoring soon if it keeps costing us more and more. We'll have to rely on pony power and public..." "There is someone in the garden. I thought there was."
Mavis stopped slicing breakfast fruit. What? It's a man. A small one, small enough almost to conceal himself in the corner behind the trunk of the apple tree. Give me that knife. Mavis swished the knife behind her back. No, Mum, leave it. Call the police. Agatha ignored her, grabbed the upturned frying pan from the draining board and unlocked, wrenched open the back door. You, she yelled. Yes, you, hiding behind that apple tree. Show yourself. There seemed no fear or apprehension in her voice. There followed a pause when nothing seemed to happen beyond the arrival of a wood pigeon on top of the wall. Agatha was about to shout something more, but a little like a snake uncoiling, a man half stood and stepped out from his hiding place. Get yourself onto the patio, Agatha snapped, and try not to step on the carrots. He looked like a prisoner from one of those 20th century Russian gulags. His head was close shaven, his eyes were gaunt, and as he picked his way onto the old stone flag patio, he seemed to have a distinct stoop. Look, I'm sorry, he started in his own defence as he stepped over carrots and onto the patio. Stop there, said Agatha. He stopped. Who are you? What are you doing in my garden? The man wanted to answer. You haven't touched my ponies, I hope. She'd noted that the side door in the garage come stable was ajar. What is it you're after? Apples? Yes, the man blurted before she could say any more. He pulled his faux denim jacket tighter about him. There was a chill in the air. I was hungry. I had nowhere to sleep, so I spent the night...
Lara pulled the scarf tighter around her head and bent down to tuck the blanket round Toby's feet in the pushchair. Dark was setting in and the streets were damp. The buggy wheels slipped on the cobblestones and rattled the pushchair, but thank goodness Toby didn't wake. If he cried, she might be reported to the guardhouse and she'd be called in to explain where she'd been all day. The villagers were meant to turn up at the market hall each morning to be given duties. Most days she was asked to help in the creche, but lately there had been fewer and fewer children, and for the last week Toby had been the only toddler. This morning she'd seen the area commandant arriving in his shiny limousine. The local guards had stood to attention, their caps with the low peaks at such an angle that they had to throw their heads back to see. Lara knew what this meant. The next contingent would be given notice to evacuate to the Moor colony. It was probably the last batch. Most of the villagers had already gone, leaving their empty houses, the sea already lapping at the doorsteps of those nearest the harbour. She passed rows of dark windows. Today she'd spent walking with Toby around the streets she'd been happy in as a child when Grandma lived in one of the big houses on the hill and Lara's mum was the village schoolteacher. In the days when there was electricity all day long, when the harbour was busy with fishing boats, when the Chinese had been far away in their own land before the takeover. Lara opened the door of her cottage and pushed Toby in. She lived in one of the highest streets in the valley with a view right across to the moor. She could see Hator rocks silhouetted black against the darkening sky like sentry posts. Lara eased herself into a standing position and rubbed her aching back while she surveyed the patch of field she'd been weeding. Along each furrow were other figures, all in navy overalls, hoeing, digging, heaving crates. Clouds were scudding past, shedding alternate light and shadows on the busy scene. In the sun, the roofs of the barracks looked like shiny havens, then plunged in and out of shades of doom. From her vantage point at the top of the field, Lara could see the sea, not so distant now as it had been filling the valleys. Sometimes on a very clear day, the tops of church spires could be seen where once whole towns had stood. At the sound of a hooter, all the workers downed tools and made their way back to the barracks. There was some desultory chat, but most seemed too tired. When they were all lined up, martial music came over the speakers and the commandant gave his usual address. Workers, we unite against the world of hunger. Give thanks to your Chinese leaders for their tireless work. As he droned on, Lara caught the eye of Mitch, the tall man opposite. His red hair and extra height singled him out, and she knew that the slightest move he made would call the attention of the guards, but he gave her a rapid wink. Nestling in a fold of the hill, almost hidden by the mossy stones and bracken, was a stone cottage.
He was crouched on the steps, hugging his knees, back against the doors of St. Lawrence's Chapel. He'd had to wait until it was dark enough to climb the black wrought iron gates when the lane would be empty of people and traffic. Beside him lay a tattered rucksack and crumpled sleeping bag, still tightly rolled. Could he survive another night in the chilly autumn air? He wished his grandma still had her cottage here in Ashburton. He'd loved visiting it as a child and sampling her scones with jam and cream. The thought made his mouth water. Instead, he reached into one of the numerous pockets of his heavy black woolen coat, his artful Dodgers gear, his friends labelled it. He fetched out a cold pasty, donated by a sympathetic tourist when he had dared to try begging. Dangerous to do so, it was strictly illegal. Not only would he be beaten and fined, he could be sent to Princetown Re-Education Centre, a place dreaded by all activists for its harsh regime administered by the uniformed cadres. Neb shivered both at the thought and because an icy wind was blowing off the moor. He was in his mid-30s, rather stockily built. His bronze skin and almond-shaped eyes betrayed his Afro-Malaysian ancestry. Grandma was Anglo-Malay, the generation that had, in her youth, seen the decline of an empire and retreated to what was then remote countryside. Neb found tears rising in his eyes as he thought of her comfortable, rather shapeless figure in a floral apron, tutting over an energy-wasting stove. She'd come from a generation that considered the environment a stable item, not to be questioned. Recycling had been a revelation to her, good soul that she was. She'd been enthusiastic with disposing of waste into the correct bins, cultivating her own vegetables, shopping at the local shops. Like himself, Grandma had loved the moor. She had recounted tales of riding her pony over the heather, which stretched for miles over the undulating hills. She was horrified when all the peat was extracted for fuel in her old age, then reforested, so Dartmoor had become a forest again, but privately owned and logged. Now, at the ripe age of 101, she was deaf and partially sighted and confined to the state geriatric unit in Exeter. Ned hadn't had the heart to tell her what had happened to the moor. Like one gigantic terraced vegetable garden. Since the Chinese occupation 10 years ago, the forest had been logged off, the profits gone to multinational companies, and the government cadres had produced their 50-year plan for sustainable food production. Taking their model from mainland China, they had sculpted terraces for vegetable production and replanted the once boggy areas with irrigation channels, perfecting the flooded land for rice cultivation. That had been the last straw for Neb. His group had opposed the plans, first legally, through protest, the courts, and appeals to government number one cadres, all to no avail. And consequently, he'd been eased out of his engineering post, found himself under suspicion of anti-national activities, ANA was the label, to become a refugee in his own country. Neb now lived from pillar to post, sleeping on friends' floors, park benches, barns, or wherever he could evade the conservation police, who enforced all government planning laws. His gran had told him about the fracas over hunting rights in the 20th century, about the lobbies for and against. Although a farmer's child, she had apparently been against deer hunting, having witnessed the suffering of exhausted deer dying in their fields. The only deer one saw nowadays, Neb reflected, were in zoos or deer farms, usually destined for a gourmet's table. Ned's immediate need was for a safe place where he could live unobserved out of the political arena. Not easy, as every district had its watchdogs who checked residence permits, which he himself did not possess. He could use his old transport pass with his surname Chan to travel incognito up to Holm and enroll as a seasonal labourer. Many of the overseers would not question his papers too closely if they needed to make up the number to fulfil their quota. Maybe he'd try that tomorrow. He spoke a passable Mandarin, like so many of the illegal and legal immigrants. Maybe later, crossed the terraces, following their line along the old drover's route that long ago sailors had taken to Plymouth. More chance there of getting a working passage to Africa, where his extended family still existed, albeit on the breadline. Well, he was getting used to hunger. The only setback would be separation from his one child. He'd not seen her since the divorce, after his expulsion from New Horizons Engineering. She must be 12 now and starting at Exeter Academy number 13. He missed her cheerful chatter and wished he could email her, but that would be unwise. Instead, he'd resorted to old-fashioned e-cards. Views of the rice paddies or the Dartmoor ponies corralled as exhibits at Sparkwell. These he sent from anonymous internet parlours. Parlours. Now that word brought back memories of Gran, dusting the mantelpiece in honour of a family visit. She rarely used the room and always lived in her warm kitchen. How he could do with some of that warmth now. He unrolled his sleeping bag, climbed in, and using his rucksack as a pillow, attempted to sleep.
You could tell from the ponies' coats their condition was poor. When Emma and Troy brushed them each morning, the tiled floor was strewn with long, coarse hair and black flecks. Tails and manes had lost their sheen. Pretty patchwork ponies now looked like Aunt Sarah's old hearth rug. Emma gripped the handful of pony hair tight, her knuckles turning white with upset. That food the feeder brings is just belly-filling fodder crap with all the goodness of texturo-polysoyethene. Yeah, sure, it's nugget-shaped, but so's my shit. Troy hid a grin. He knew he'd be for it if she saw. Well, it's all your mum can afford now, though, innit, bae? How many tokens did you get last week for that tourist tour, comedy claptrap tour, wasn't it? Troy prepared himself for Emma's tirade about more tokens, watching her own teenage skin redden and spots brighten on her chin. A black car pulled into the Linhay Heritage Pony Centre at the top of Ashburton. A 16-seater, blackened window, hydrogen-powered charabang, 36 reg, silently pulled into the pony park. It didn't look to Emma or Troy like the usual tourist vehicle, and anyway, it was out of season, and definitely not a local for their park and pony or delivery service. A woman alighted. She walked straight into the office where Agatha sat. Emma's mother had three screens up and was scanning her accounts for the last 3 months, Jan to March. Tokens, 58,000. Coinage, 11,000, she read. Her stress increased when the woman entered. She'd been expecting her, and she invited her to sit down. The woman began. Oh, she was impeccably trained. Perfect eye contact, warm and boundaried introduction, a positive preceding a negative, apparently spontaneous conversation. Don't waste your breath, thought Agatha, averting her gaze and refusing to play. I bet she's not paid in tokens on all her bullshitty training courses. So, how long will this contract be for, Elaine? She asked plainly. Oh, it's great news, said Elaine. I'm really excited about the package we've put together for you and your unique situation, Agatha. It's 36 months. The feeder will arrive 4 times a week instead of our usual 3. The ponies walk onto the trailer, eat all they can for a special extended 25 minutes optimum grazing time and leave. And this year, we've included vitamin K and Linksite for maximum health benefits. I'd like to talk to you about dung options, signposted Elaine. Now, if we take it away for recycling, I can offer you a further reduction. If you keep it, then it's only 27.5 more. So, are we starting to talk shit here now, or are we? Now are we? That's interesting. Agatha sat back in her chair to think over her few remaining options. All through school that day, Emma found it extra hard to concentrate. It hurt her to see the ponies suffering for something as simple as the right to graze them all. Her pony, Ruby, was visibly thinning and hardly flicked a tail at Emma anymore. She knew she was cross about that. That was nothing new. Emma said her mum had said that she was born cross. Decibel, they'd called her when she was little. Well, it's only 'cause her cares, Aunt Sarah would say. Her discomfort, her unnamed distress, lasted until bedtime. She didn't even resist going to bed. And as she lay down, from the bottle of her anger, an idea popped into her head. Emma, Troy, Kate, and Neb untied the ponies at dawn. Neb had helped with the final plan. If there was one thing he knew how to do, it was to take action. He knew so many things, but being homeless channeled his talents into the basics of living. Plus, his short-term memory wasn't what it was. He could tell that things were changing in Ashburton when the ex-political activist was being asked in to help more and more frequently. They led the ponies out of Lynn Hay, up past the disused quarry, past rows of empty houses, and began to climb the steep hills. Neb pointed out, well, this would be easier if the hedgerows were still here, but you know, the car is more important than the bush, he said in a mock authoritarian voice. What do they have here in the hedgerows, Neb? Asked Troy. Neb was a talker, and he told stories of the hedges and pathways all the way up to the moor edge. Those who saw them couldn't care less. They waited at the moor gate, behind a few remaining beech trees. The diggers were just cranking up, their steel frames silhouetting the sky as they started to reap the remaining peat from Dartmoor. Trucks waited to take it away to be burnt elsewhere, burnt to death.
No, I'm not going to. But you want to live here, don't you? Yes. Well then. So? How are you going to if you haven't got a job? What job? There are no jobs here. But if you get a degree, you could teach or work for the park. Kate made a noise of derision. You've got to do something. I'm staying here. I'll do the exams, but I'm staying here. To do what? What you do. Oh, don't be ridiculous. She got up. Why is it ridiculous? Do you want to live like this, from hand to mouth? No, and I'm not going to. I'm not you. I'll do it better than you. I'll make money. I'll buy a house. I won't spend my life wiping their floors and washing their bedding. I don't. I'll work in bars. There's plenty of work in the King's Arms and the hotel, and I'll save. If you really want to stay, why don't you do the pony and trap course with Emma? Or we could see if Agatha would have you. You know how highly she thinks of you, all those years of mucking out. And I hardly ever got to ride. I know. Backing that wretched animal up lanes for hours on end. That wasn't the deal. Is that it? Is it the horses? Kate didn't answer. I'm sorry we could never afford for you to ride. Emma only could because of her mother. All right. If you get a good job, a degree, then you would be able... All right, enough. I'm staying. I'm not going to try for university. Years of debt and living in some smelly city. I'd prefer to scrub floors here. I'm going to bed. She didn't quite slam the door. Relations with the neighbours were bad enough, and she always got the worst of it, as they turned their telly up against her wall if she annoyed them. They always seemed to know if it was her. Cottages, they were called, these flimsy dwellings, but they weren't like real cottages, and no one wanted to buy them. Tiny, pokey, unregulated things for her and her mother to live in and serve the people in the real cottages, stone and solid. She looked out of her window, miserable. That's what lay ahead if she was to have a horse. She couldn't say that to her mother, of course. It would seem a ludicrous ambition, but it was what she wanted. And they didn't have horses in London or wherever they kept universities. No horses there, no. The only way was to stay here and do whatever jobs there were and get one somehow. At least horses worked here, and there was still some land. From her window in daylight, she could see the wilderness, the forbidden land, where the ponies roamed except for the drift. Now all she could see was the waterman's light. He was sitting at his desk, writing or reading. He told her to go to London, grinning in that self-satisfied way. They'd be off tomorrow in their permitted vehicle, and their house would be empty for a week or two or more. The following morning, as usual on a school day, she was up at 5. It was many years since the school minibus had come any closer than the main road, and that meant an hour and a half's walk to the bus stop. All right in the summer, but not in the winter, and it was autumn now and dark and getting colder. Her mother was usually asleep when she left. She worked now most evenings in the pub, but this morning she was up and waved her off. A good thing and a prophetic one. Nor was it raining. Also good. She'd been going about half an hour and the road was running parallel to the wilderness, when she felt something move in the undergrowth. She stopped. Too big for a fox, and not a deer. They were never seen if they didn't wish to be. Nothing. She walked on, warily. The sound of bracken, and she turned suddenly. Who's there? Though she knew that no one could break through the dense thicket of wires beside the road, then she saw him. Stop. A boy, it seems, stood up and ran. Stop or I'll tell on you. And he stopped and turned back. Don't tell. They'll hunt me. How did you get in? There are ways for those who know. Well, you can't be good at it. I saw you. That was an accident. Show me. How do I know I can trust you? You don't. Show me. She felt a confidence she'd never felt before. Always following her mother's ways or disobeying, or abiding by school's prohibitions. This was new. This was power. He did show her. He directed her the way, this way and that, until she was the other side of the wires and had missed the bus. Here were trees and brambles and the things of ordinary life, but they lived and grew, it seemed, by different rules. From here, finding the paths and looking onto the village in the evening, she looked into her life from the outside and felt a new beginning, and it was good.
I remember playing around the pepper pot when I was 10. Playing? There were always too many cars for kids then. Yeah, sure, but I'll still remember it. It's sad they're bringing it down, I know. But have you seen the plans for the new market house? Much more original. It'll bring in a lot of tourists, we want. We want tourists? They do pay for all of this Dartmoor to exist. The last stones from the pepper pot were carefully marked, and work was ready in the morning to rip up the tarmac and lay the cobbles. Not exactly true to history, but very heritage-like. And the dirt square just wouldn't survive few cars and delivery vehicles allowed into central Chagford. The bypass, carefully using existing lanes, had transformed small-town life over the past two decades. How's Jimmy? He's doing well. I videoed him yesterday. He does so much like working in Botswana. I'm afraid he's not like us. He's thriving and working in the New World powerhouse. Any girlfriend? Well, he's seeing a local girl. She sounds sweet, but what? Well, I know it's not politically correct, but go on, we're too old to bother about being PC. Yeah, it's just, she's a Christian. A proper one, he says. Oh. And what? She kind of expects him to share her values. She says that progress is their Christian duty. The care of people and the betterment of all people is their Christian duty. But he doesn't have to agree with her. Jimmy's always been different. Even when he was young, he was always questioning us. Oh well, he'll come back here and settle down. I'm afraid I don't think he will. He says he wants to work on in Botswana. Oh well, at least things won't change here. Ah yes, but this new market square. What are they saying? Chagford Market? The peace of the Relmore community? I don't know, it'll be different. A little change is sometimes okay. It's all funded by the European Commonwealth. Thank God for that. The English government is just interested in bickering and arguing. Ever since the Labour and Tories committed suicide with their running away from the Anglo-American intervention in the Panama crisis. One bark from the Chinese and they ran. Do you remember? Yes, I was young then. What? Must have been 41. I remember woke up to the humiliation. Thank God we survived. Dartmoor's still the same, though. People all think we're all conservative old fuddy-duddies, parked away in some royal dream. Well, we are. One of the few places in England where progress hasn't happened much. Less cars, though. Yes. And healthier ones, too. Congestion charges help that. Oh, yeah, and the fuel cells. We still grow all our own food. I do like the place to proper food. My Rarina, she hardly ever sees the inside of a supermarket. Orders direct from some Moroccan operation with warehouses around England. I thought I'd hate the high streets disappearing. But you know, I think they're better now. No shops. Only a few people businesses. Apartments, cafes, even extra. I hate to say it, but I kind of like it. Oh, I do miss Boots. Chagford's got more shops too. Thank God for the Stannery Parliament, that's what I said.
I have lived all my long life in Chagford. I'm nearly 80, which is the age that I will have to face the Longevity Control Board. That consists of 7 experts, which will include my own GP, Dr. Phillips. The trouble with old Phillips is that he wants to keep everyone happy and is unlikely to speak up for me in a convincing way. He has to keep up with the quota of natural wastage. That is not the only difficult decision that he has to make. Since the government has given GPs the power to choose who should be treated and who should take responsibility for their own actions, there have been several early deaths in the community. Take George Endicott, for example. He ignored government guidelines about fried breakfast and clotted cream. Well, he put on so much weight that he hadn't set foot outside of his front door since 56. Of course, that was old Philip's predecessor. But when George started getting chest pains, they gave him a large dose of morphine and finished him off. He was only 30-something, but he had ignored the new obesity laws and paid the penalty. I have been very careful to keep my slate clean. At my monthly weigh-in, I never gained more than a kilo or two. I might have had the old fag in the safety of my own home, but when Dartmoor Security started being involved with clean air enforcement, I was forced to give up. One visit from that peasant Wayne saw to that. Nobody else knows about the fags, so that should be all right. The other factor that the board takes into account is how much the health service has already spent on you. I reckon that they may give me another 2 years, providing I can keep on working in the community allotments.
The tracks were fresh. Even the morning's downpour had not washed out the sharp edges where the earth had been turned over. Bore. No doubt about it now. He'd followed the trail further across the hillside, away from the fence, from where he'd cut the line. Some time since he'd seen a fresh trail. They had been plentiful before the camp. Now they were mostly hunted out, food for the ever-hungry bellies of the camp. He looked up. The sun was low in the sky. Another hour of daylight, maybe more. There was no time to prolong this chase, but still he squeezed his heels into the pony's flanks and let her take him through the scrub. From here he could see above the rowan saplings that clothed the hillside in a continuous tract of forest. The pony parted the scrub and pushed its way on. He'd promised his girl there'd be food this evening, without knowing how he'd keep that word. Scylla had been overwrought when he left. The results would mean so much to her, a place in further education and a chance to shine, or if things did not come out as planned, follow father into the ranger service. When had the job changed, he asked. When had he stopped guiding, educating, helping, and looking after the visitors? When had his job changed from being a shepherd to being a guard? It had seemed so trivial when the first families had moved up into the high valley and set up home with their tents and timber cabins. At first, the authority had wanted him to move them on, but soon it was clear they were there to stay and joined by many others. And then it became a place to dump people, a depot for the unwanted mass of migrants moving north, away from the swamped land and the scorched land. So he'd helped the authority build the fence, and built it high, and built it strong. And now he rode, patrolling the perimeter, containing the mass that wanted to expand. No life, really. Just an extended existence. Water in plenty, if you took it from high up. Lower down, you took your choice between the effluent and the radon gas. But food was different. The supply train had never kept pace with the burgeoning population of the camp. Small wonder then that so many chose to brave the patrols, to scale the fence and forage. The pony pushed through the scrub into a small clearing. More tracks. A movement at the edge caught his eye. Leaves flashing reflected light in the evening sun. He reached forward, unlaced the leather strap, and withdrew the leather strap slowly through the buckle. Opening the scabbard, he drew out the rifle and held it around the narrow handle by the butt, balancing it against his thigh. He nudged the pony forward, the leaves rustling again, and dropping the rein, he raised the rifle to his shoulder and sighted along the barrel. The boy lay before him, half hidden in the scrub, looking up wide-eyed at the rifle. So pale for one from the camp. His leg was twisted beneath him, and his clothing blotched with blood.
I can't say where I am. I won't say who I am. Well, perhaps a clue. Call me Rue, short for Rueful. It ought to be stronger. Devastated would be better. This is an experiment in how to escape. Recovery might take longer. Others have been through much the same. I don't know how they survive. But one's own trauma always seems worse. A breakup and a breakdown brought me here. And I have to find the words. Simple on the face of it. A wife who was two-timing me with a close mate of mine, would you believe? And us with two kids. I can't believe how none of us twigged what was going on. It's my ignorance I deplore, but thankful for theirs. I had to move out, and she, devil in disguise, I don't know how, landed me with a child enrichment program. I'd never been one to bother with rights and that sort of thing. I ought to, because one of the next things was that the internet company who'd commissioned me to do a left-handed creativity diorama reneged. I was in such turmoil mentally, how could I work on it? And of course, they got someone else on board with the same idea. You can only take so many knocks. I lived off friends for a while. Okay, but there's only so much sympathy you can feed on. And I needed space and time to think myself through. Somewhere they can't get me. That's what brought me here. And where do you go when times have shot you to pieces? Back to beginnings. I'm not far from the village I grew up in. It won't give anything away if I say not far from the moors. And what goes through my mind as I sit in this makeshift encampment, fetched up in a crevice between two granite outcrops? They won't shift. My granddad and his stories of how life used to be. He told me of the times he'd sit with his mates on the bank of a skateboard park, talking of their futures. How Ben wanted to be a carpenter. Yes, he had an apprenticeship lined up. And Jay was about to go on a music technology degree in London. Hell, they got jobs. And now he hadn't a clue what he really wanted to do. Just wanted things to be different. You can't change the system if you're still working with the same models, he'd say. You need new thinking. It's hard to escape revolution. And sometimes things have to collapse before you can rebuild. I owe my granddad a lot. He told me about the elephants when we went to the zoo, how few were left in the wild with the droughts and the bloody free-for-alls in the ivory trade, and how a matriarch might die in the plains of Africa, and how the herd would return often to the corpse, running their trunks over the bones, as if to sense the spirit that might have lain within. He told me the stories written in the very bones of Dartmoor about Child's Tomb, actually a Saxon, who took his horse out one winter, got caught in a blizzard, and to survive had to disembowel his horse and took refuge within the carcass. But what about the horse, Grandad, I'd say. Life's sometimes tough, lad, he'd reply over those half-rimmed glasses that always made me think of him as the wise professor with a conjurer's twinkle in his eye. And that was enough. He'd say no more, though my questions would go on and on inside. But that story was a metaphor for me. To survive, you have to get under the skin. That's what I made of it. Later, of course. I brought enough here with me to get by on. Tins, candles, a stove, matches. Yeah, I haven't been on a rubbing two sticks together course. And an old sleeping bag and a roll left over from my camping days. It'll do. There's enough space in this crevice for me to lie out diagonally, just about. And what do? I'm getting close to nature, like Grandad did. You'd never guess, he said, but an owl's hearing is 20 times better than yours. He'd probably hear me breathing then, if he was up in this tree then. Likely, lad. And those peregrine falcons, know how fast they fly? Nearly 200 miles an hour in a swoop. I couldn't believe it. Now's my chance to see for myself. I set out this morning, and luck was on my side. Saw this sparrowhawk perched still as night on a stunted hawthorn. Just waiting he was. Seemed like ages. I skimmed, I crouched, mesmerized as he seemed to be. And then some bird, I think blackbird, female, flew past. He shot off the branch, caught the bird in mid-flight, and brought it to ground, stamped on it up and down to kill every last vestige of life, and tore it to pieces. I went over when he'd finished. Only feathers left, not a bone in sight. I can still hear him. Life's tough, lad, but I'm learning.
On Skorrel Island, lying amongst gorse needles, I pant and drip and shiver. The freezing river flows all around me and the dogs are calling closer. Wading upstream, bags held high, I had stumbled, taken a ducking. Now my hair is stiff with ice, but the bags feel dry. I relax slightly, thanking the gorse and wind-stunted trees for hiding me and praying to the stars to misguide Wayne and his lackeys. The dog's barks recede. I pull my head down into my cloak and let exhaustion take me. I dream of the days when I would wake in the same soft bed every morning. Mum would scold me up, dressed, clean and fed for 9 o'clock, when I would sit with my brothers at the kitchen table for school. Dad wasn't often home, but when he was, Mum would let him take us on long walks over the moors for a different kind of schooling. My dad, the archetypal provider, would have pockets full of good things. If we could spot and name a plant and list all its uses, his oversized hand would rummage in his deerskin coat and emerge with some wonder, often new to our eyes. My brothers most wanted the edible treats, honeycomb wrapped in duck, salted boar scratchings, fruit from abroad. But for me, he would carry beads and bangles, a hat covered in mirrors, pencils and creams for painting my face. I loved those days, and am grateful now that I knew how much I loved them while they were happening. I could run as fast as any of them if we were seen by security, and at 13 I had faced the same trial as my brothers, to throw an ivy crown round the horns of a running bull. I couldn't match Dad or Ray, my older brother, for strength, but I was the lightest on my feet, so in a dark wood they could never find me, and I could always cover my tracks. When Dad left again to collect the meat, smuggled, poached, or entirely without provenance, and barter it round the moor, Mum would lead us in praying, hands on granite, for his safe keeping. He knew who would want what, and the people were glad to see him come. But he had a soft heart, soft as mud, Mum said when she knew we were listening, and wouldn't take more than they could afford, often just a share of their evening meal. Nor would he stay the night, no matter the temperature, for fear of incriminating them with security. But for all this, we lived better than most up here. We grew our veg most of the year and had enough salt for preserving, and of course we had the meat. I was 15 when Wayne finally tracked Dad home. It was night and I was woken by gunshot. Mum screamed once, but more shots silenced her. I couldn't hear my brothers. I left them in the care of the moon and leapt from my window, hitting the ground running to give me a chance against the dogs, but the fools had tethered them. I sprinted downhill to the leat, then doubled back, bracken now covering my bare footprints, and headed over the hill to an abandoned badger set. If the dogs found me, there would be no escape, but I hoped the men would think the dogs smelled badgers. I had crept to the centre chamber, perpetually dark and surprisingly warm. I don't know how long I was there, no light reached me. But the dogs never came. Dartmoor was on my side. I went home just once. My brothers had never made it out of their beds. On mine was a streak of blood in the shape of a W. They wanted me too. I took all I could run with and fled. For all the education Mum had so passionately given me, my future was clear. Now I had become the butcher. I'm woken by a tear trickling into my ear. My hair is still frozen, and I know it's dangerous to be still any longer. What's more, Claire's expecting again, and she's lost two already this year. Her husband will pay me well for the meat in my bags, and I can stand in their kitchen, bathing in the smells of home.
Fiona is married to Charlie. Fiona has always been married to Charlie. Fiona will always be married to Charlie. They have four dogs, six horses, and two children, semicolon. And they used to be very happy. Charlie is a European Army officer. He's serving with the Petroleum Protection Services in an area that used to be called Iraq. When he comes home, Fiona is always working, and he never sees her. Why is Fiona always working? Because she feels guilty. They live on Dartmoor, which is still a national park, despite enormous pressure on its resources. And they have always kept horses. Fiona is a natural businesswoman and enjoys organising things. And it was natural that she offer riding lessons and that they'd be a great success. Until Katie died. Katie was a nice little girl and she really loved ponies. She wanted one of her own, but her parents couldn't afford it. Her father is a prison officer and her mother is a nurse, and they don't have very much money. They could only afford to live on Dartmoor because of social policy. And they were extremely grateful when Katie's grandmother offered to pay for Katie's lessons at the local stables with Fiona, whom everyone said was so competent, so professional, so safe. They are not so grateful now. On her fifth lesson, Katie wore her new riding clothes as if she had always worn them and was beginning to understand what she was doing. Fiona decided that Katie was ready to go out on the road for a walk on a very safe pony in a group under supervision with a very careful instructor. It was a 42-ton lorry and it shouldn't have been on Dartmoor at all. The driver had the newest issue of sat-nav, but he couldn't understand it. He was from Poland, and when it told him to go northeast, he went. He came up behind the string and just touched his horn ever so slightly. At least, that was what he said at the inquest. Katie's pony bolted away from her, and when she hit the dry stone wall beside the church where she would be buried, she didn't have a chance. Everyone came to the funeral, and Katie's mother made a very nice speech. It could have happened to anyone, she said. It was an accident, she said. She didn't blame Fiona at all, she said. Katie's father didn't say anything. He was too busy crying. Now Fiona is never at home and she works all the time. Charlie worries about her. He thinks they will take away her license. And then what will she do? Fiona is married to Charlie. Fiona has always been married to Charlie. Fiona will always be married to Charlie. They used to be very happy.
The farmyard was quiet. It always was these days, since the directive that said all stock must be kept inside until further noticed. Joan shook out a sheet from the laundry basket and pegged it on the line. It felt thin and slippery and made her long for the sheets she remembered from childhood. Proper cotton with a feel and smell all their own. She hadn't seen cotton sheets for years now. The ones she was hanging out to dry were made from oil. She had no idea how, but lots of things were, since the directive that halted the use of oil for transport. She sniffed the sheets again and fancied that they did have a faintly oily smell. She attached her last peg to the line, the pegs were made from oil too, and looked at the sky, still blue and clear, a perfect day, which, like as not, meant visits. As she walked back to the house with the basket, she heard it. The bleeping of the Envirobot as it sailed quietly into the farmyard and hovered while its lenses had a good snoop around. The lights on its underside twinkled, and then it moved past her, over the washing line and away across the fields. Joan sighed. She knew the screen in her kitchen would be telling her to take in the washing, and sure enough, when she got in, the monitor was telling her that she had an hour before a visit. Children this time, from Plymouth.
coming for exercise and the outdoor experience. Fields 9 and 7, said the monitor. Please check for hazards. Joan liked the children best of all the visitors. At least they looked as though they liked running about in the fields. But Joan thought they'd like it more if the animals were there too. She thought about disobeying her instructions and leaving the washing out. But she knew that the bot, NV as it was known, would check. And if she hadn't complied, it would alert Wayne. And she didn't want him sticking his big nose into her outbuildings. Were the fields 9 and 7 clear? She had been clearing nettles and dots over the last few days, but she always collected her tools and brought them in with her. It was habit, not necessity. No one was going to take them when security was so efficient. She took the washing off the line and fed and watered the poultry from the kitchen. It didn't seem right just pressing the buttons on the monitor, feed and water, but what could she do? She wondered if the visiting children had ever seen animals. Surely it would do no harm to let a few of the sheep out into an adjoining field. What could security actually do to her if she disobeyed the directive? Perhaps all that would happen would be that Wayne might have to get his shiny boots muddy, putting the sheep back inside again. Joan would like to see that. She would. She began to walk in the direction of the sheep units. Soon she was running. In the distance, she could already see, sailing over Shilston Tor, the airship that would deposit its cargo of children into her clean field. She carried on running and reached the big shed that housed the sheep. She pressed the open sequence on the keypad of the big door and stood back as they swung open. The sheep looked up from their troughs in surprise. Come on, you, she shouted at them. Come on out. The sheep didn't move, so Joan stepped into the shed. Come on, out. In the next field, the airship touched down, sleek and silent. Joan could hear children's voices. The sheep could hear them too, and an old ewe cautiously approached the door. Go on, she said. The other sheep began to follow. As they moved out of the shed, they began to run up the green field. The field was filling with white bodies. Joan looked across at the airship. The children had retreated and were standing in a huddle beside the ship, staring at the sheep. What was wrong with them? Joan wondered. But she knew. The children were scared. They won't hurt you, yelled Joan. She could hear a siren already. Wayne's car was hurtling over the grass towards her. He was shouting, You know they can't go near the sheep. Have you gone mad? Joan thought perhaps she had, but she was laughing.
Melania gazed out of the hut doorway at Bonehill Tor and luxuriated in the warmth of the November sunshine as it scorched her bare brown arms. The moorland slopes up to Bonehill Rocks and Hilldown Tor were swathed in the sulphur yellow blossoms of the oilseed herb oleagina. It'll be a good harvest this year, Melania, Sebastothorn interrupted her reverie. The seeds are setting well now that we've bartered these bees with the Hameldown tribe at Chagford, and the honey will be useful in the winter months of January and February. We've had three harvests this year already, but we need the seeds for the oil. The mechanised plough drinks the fuel, but it's twice as quick as the oxen ploughing those steep slopes. Your Jeb will be interested in taking some over to Hexworthy to sell to the community there, Melania. He's got a real eye and nose for the sharp business deal, hasn't he? I know, Melania sighed and trailed off. He's nearly 18 now and talking of moving out of our settlement and joining those seashore dwellers near the old settlement called Plymouth. He says that he doesn't like our life here at Nova Widdicombe and our old ways. He wants more than living in our settlement, built from the stones of the old Widdicombe after the Great Flood in 2012. He wants the kind of life his great-great-grandparents had before the Flood. He wants things, Sebastothorn. He says he wants a different future. I know he's young and spirited. Sebastothorn sat down at the communal oak table and fastened the thongs on his leather boots. The chickens scuttled in from the herb garden and began to peck at the earth floor. Melania sat down next to him on the oak bench and twisted her braided hair absent-mindedly. I only want what's best for him, but I worry that he'll regret moving away from the settlement and our peaceful life. You can't stop him, Sebastothorn snapped. He's almost a man now and often takes the cart to trade with the village people around. He seems so like his great-grandfather, Joseph. It's since your girl, Viswena, found those old pictures of the moorland before the flood. great-grandfather Joseph with his big Land Rover in the old village of Widdicombe. The moorland was covered in bracken and gorse in those days, Melania. I know. It was before the sea oil ran out and the great banking collapse. It was all in 2012, just before the flood. Jeb wants that kind of life and he's set on a path to get it. Melania sat down at the spinning wheel and began to pull the tangled wool into a thread. The rhythm of the wheel spinning from the foot treadle calmed her. In the herb garden outside the hut, strong plants were waiting to yield their colours and medicines. The water wheel brought the water up from the settlement pond and fed the garden in a thread of leeks, which glittered in the late autumn sunshine.
Great Ball Play of Darty Moor. My name is Albert. My dad's name was Albert. Guess my granddad's name. Albert. That's right. I'm a ball clay engineer. My dad was a ball clay engineer. Guess what my granddad did?
Was he a ball clay engineer?
No, you're wrong. There weren't no need for ball clay then. He was a quarryman, like his dad, and like his dad's dad too. I have three sons. Eldest 15, next 13, youngest 10. Guess my eldest's name.
Albert?
No, it ain't Albert. Albert was before TV. My eldest is called Bruce, from Bruce Forsyth. You know, that smooth guy from TV. A proper laugh he is. I likes Bruce, so my eldest is called Bruce. My youngest is called Dennis, after that Coronation Street chap. You know, Dirty Den, he was called. As I told you, I'm a ball clay engineer. My dad was a ball clay engineer. Guess what my eldest wants to be? No, it ain't a ball clay engineer. He's a bit of a bother. Nothing for him to do out here in the moor. Nothing but little cold houses here in Leemore. Nothing for him to do. So he's in trouble with police. Nothing wrong, really. It would be called high spirits if he were a tough. But he's the son of a ball clay worker, and that don't count for nothing these days. Some foreign firm owns his dad. Lock, stock and barrel. That's a fact. Dartmoor Prison. That's what Bruce calls this place. Says there's nothing to do here. That's why he's in trouble. Says he don't care if they send him to the prison. He won't know any difference, except he'd been told it's warmer in there with TV, good food, and you don't have to work either. I don't even try to get him a job with the ball clay. He says he's okay with ball and chain. What's the point? He's no fool. He knows only too well that digging ball clay is all about machines now. 10 of us can do what more than 100 did when I were his age. Latest machine is expensive, but 3 of us will work shifts in a year or two, keeping it busy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Will I be one of the lucky 3? Who knows? They could bring in foreign workers. They cost less and ask for less. Subcontractors, they call them. No national health contributions for them. No unions either. But that's progress, ain't it?
Mummy, come quickly.
Sally turned from the sink where she was washing clothes. What is it, Jake? A monster, Mummy. It's huge. It's coming along the track. She dried her hands on a towel as she hurried outside, afraid the bull had got loose. Jake was standing on the fence rail, pointing in horror at the approaching... She smiled and lifted him in her arms. That's a tractor, my dear, not a monster. See, Daddy's sitting on it. Jake rubbed his tear-stained face against her shirt. But it's noisy with smoke. It's eating Daddy. No, dear, it's a machine. Daddy's borrowing it to help plough the lower field. It's been so dry, the ground is hard, and Daisy and Dan can't pull the plough through it. Jake wriggled from her grasp. But they must. He turned big, frightened eyes to her. You won't kill them and eat them? No, dear. They'll have a bit of a rest. She gazed towards the paddock, where the horses stood listlessly drooping their heads in the heat. Let's go and give them some water. She thought of the well, almost dried up, hardly adequate for the needs of the family, cattle and horses, but they needed the livestock and must care for them. Glancing indoors to check that Penny was asleep in her crib, Sally filled two buckets and walked down to the paddock, Jake trotting by her side. The grass was burned in the unrelenting sun, and the horses had stripped most of the lower branches of the trees. The cattle, fortunately, were down in a hollow, where a desultory trickle came from a spring, but at least the grass was green and Buttercup was still giving milk. How different it was when she was growing up. Abundant food, cars, machinery, mains electricity, mains water in the towns, though not here on the moor. Now it was feast or famine. The winter storms had washed away much of the topsoil, so the upper fields were almost barren, the sparse grass so susceptible to drought and invasion by deep-rooted weeds. Jake patted the soft noses of the horses as they drank from the buckets. I won't let them hurt you, he whispered. We don't eat horses, his mother assured him. They're our friends. But Fluffy was my friend and we ate her. Sheep are different. They're bred for wool and meat. It was so difficult to explain to a two-year-old. Let's go and see if Daddy's brought the tractor in. Jake trailed behind as Sally tried to lead him up to the farmhouse. It's all right, she cooed. Daddy's not in any danger. The tractor was rumbling in the yard. Jake held back. Come on, Jakey, his father urged. You won't see one of these very often. It's horrid. I don't want to. His father lifted the boy in his arms. It won't hurt you. It's come to help for a few days. He gazed over the boy's head at Sally. If only, he murmured. She knew he was regretting the decline of the mechanical age. Oil and petrol had been almost exhausted worldwide, and fuel was so expensive. With so little machinery now, there were few spare parts and even fewer mechanics to do repairs. It was quite impractical for them to consider a tractor of their own. Anyway, they usually managed very well with the horses. A slower pace of life, but more satisfying, being in tune with nature. With the solar panels, they had electricity, so they weren't back to the dark ages. Email and internet kept them in touch with the outside world and would in time facilitate education for the children without the need of scarce transport.
And of course they do so devalue one's property, Mrs. Dorr is saying as I walk into the village shop. From behind the counter, Jenny Toop, whose family has had our village shop for as long as anyone can remember. Well, her mum and dad was keeping the shop when I was little, and their mum and dad before that when my mum was a girl. Anyway, Jenny Toop, she glances in my direction and at once gives Mrs. Dorber a meaningful look, which obviously Mrs. Dorber doesn't take on board because she goes on regardless. Social housing, indeed, she says. It should never have been allowed, not here in Dartmoor, of all places. My husband and I are absolutely devastated. I feel like throttling her from behind, but instead, I walk out of the shop again, slamming the door as hard as I can, and I make my way towards St. Stephen's. It being a Monday, it's the morning when I church clean, polish the brasses, take Sunday's dirty linen home to wash and all that, but my mind is seething all the way. And besides, I haven't had an email or anything from my Robert in Elman Province for days and days now, and I'm going out of my mind with worry without Mrs. Dorber, who only comes down here from London once in a blue moon anyway, and whose des res on the edge of Dartmoor is surrounded by a wall so high that she and her stockbroken husband can't possibly see anything of the scenery beyond it, let alone our six little houses in Manor Close. that she objects to so much. Well, I can do without Mrs. Dauber adding to all my problems. But of course, I can't get flaming Mrs. Dauber and her snidey remarks out of my mind, so as soon as I'm inside St. Stephen's, I explode. Bloody Mrs. Dauber, bloody Afghanistan, bloody everything. And then I notice Denise Bailey fiddling about with the flowers down by the lectern, and I just wish the floor would open up and swallow me. But Denise, she just purses her lips, which is her way of smiling, and she comes over to me and she says, "Now come on, Tory, I think you could do with a cup of coffee. No, don't make any excuses. The cleaning to wait."